The question I'd like to start with is, what are these verses doing here? This is not a passage about worship. It's a passage about sanctification. Chapter 5, verse 1, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children. This is about imitating God, reflecting His moral character. Verse 15, therefore be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. And so don't be drunk with wine, for that is dissipation. What's this about singing? In a section that's concerned with our being imitators of God and walking wisely and avoiding sin. Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Because I think the placement of these verses here has a lot to say to us about the importance of the musical environment in which we are living. That part of our sanctification, an important element of it, is our attitude toward our involvement with music. Music has a tremendous impact upon us. Music matters. And while this is not a passage about worship, it does inform our worship, but the main thing that it's about is it's about sanctification. It's about walking wisely. And so being alert to the kind of musical environment in which we are living and ensuring that the musical environment is one that promotes edification and growth rather than one that is destructive and detrimental to spiritual growth. Music matters, and it matters a lot. And when I say music, I mean both lyrics and the music itself. Music is not merely a matter of style or taste or opinion. There is good music and there is bad music. And there are good lyrics and there are bad lyrics. What makes music or lyrics good or bad? Whether or not they're conducive to moral ends versus the opposite. There is music that is conducive of moral formation in us. And then there is music that is destructive of that moral formation. That would be the view, I believe, of the apostles. It's clearly the view of the church fathers. It is the view of the reformers. It is the view of the ancient philosophers before the church fathers. It's even the view of the modern philosophers up until the 20th century. That is, that there is good music and bad music. There is music that is conducive of moral ends, and there is music that is destructive of moral ends. And so that's why we need to pay attention to our musical environment. And that's why the Apostle Paul is dealing with it here in this place, in this epistle. So let's start with the importance of music. The modern view, well summarized by Rick Warren of Purpose Driven Church and Saddleback Church, he says music is nothing more than an arrangement of notes and rhythms. He says that there is no such thing as Christian music, only Christian lyrics. I would say that's the majority view. That's the way most people, and indeed most Christians, look at it today. And so all styles are equally acceptable for pleasure, and all styles are equally acceptable for worship. Now, the classic view of music would be utterly astonished at this claim. Let's go back to Plato. And as we do, I'm acknowledging that there are some sermons that are more like lectures and some lectures that are more like sermons. This is going to be a sermon that's more like a lecture. But bear with me if you would. Go back to Plato. Plato gave the first place to music in education because of the capacity of rhythm and harmony, as he put it, to insinuate themselves into the inmost part of the soul and most vigorously lay hold of it. First place in education. Aristotle says that we are altered in soul when we listen to music. Cicero, perhaps the greatest of the Roman philosophers, complained even as he contrasted the hardy, vigorous music of an earlier age with the degenerate music of his own, of the late Republic of Rome. Quintilian and Seneca, also of that late Republican early empire period of time, complained of the moral and artistic degeneracy of the music of their day. To summarize what their view is, As I understand it, basically the view of the ancient world was, as expressed by the Greek philosophers, is that there is music that assists us in ordering and disciplining our souls. The problem for us in trying to improve and grow and mature, whether it's educationally or in our physical stature, is the matter of discipline. We have to control ourselves in order to grow and mature and develop. We have to control our impulses. We can't just do and say and think whatever happens to pop into our mind at any given moment. We can't be just a slave to our passions and a slave to our impulses. All those things have to be disciplined so that we are able to give ourselves to the difficult, strenuous tasks of educating ourselves and of developing morally, of developing self-control, of saying no to evil and good, yes to righteousness, developing, say even physically. If you want to develop physically, then you're going to have to work at it. You're going to need to have the discipline to run. You can't just follow your impulse and say, well, I don't feel like running right now. You're going to need to discipline yourself and run. You're going to need to discipline yourself and lift heavy objects in order to develop your muscles and say no to your lazy side that wants to just relax or pursue pleasure or play. Are you with me? Now, what they're saying is that there is music that is conducive to the ends of discipline, that helps bring order to the soul, that brings discipline to the soul, that assists you in developing self-control. And there is music, however, that appeals immediately to your senses and that encourages the immediate expression of your impulses, the immediate expression of your desires, that encourages self-gratification moment by moment, and so is destructive of the purposes and ends of discipline. Two kinds of music. Good music that helps order and discipline the soul. Bad music, which encourages you to express your emotions immediately, that encourages the immediate expression of impulses and self-gratification. As you move into then the next period, the period of the church fathers, the early Christians, you find that they all have that same view. Clement of Alexandria, who lived from approximately 150 to 215 A.D., Tertullian, from 160 to 225, Basil the Great from 330 to 379, Ambrose and Augustine, essentially of the same period, are uniform and vehement. According to one of the authors I've been reading, in their denunciation of pagan music. Basil the Great, for example, says that the passions born of illiberality and baseness of spirit are naturally occasioned by this sort of music. The passions born of illiberality and baseness are stirred up by, he's saying, by this kind of music that encourages the immediate expression of your impulses, of your desires and passions. Augustine was very cautious about music and its power to corrupt. For example, he cautioned the church, finding nothing in pagan music that was of use for Christians. Christians, Augustine said, should not turn to pagan theatrical trivialities to discover whether anything valuable for spiritual purposes is to be gathered from their harps and other instruments. In other words, don't go to the pagan world to figure out what kind of music is going to assist the church in its ministry and worship. Don't go to the world to try to find the kind of music that's going to be edifying for believers. Don't think that you're going to find it there. In other words, we're going to have to develop our own kind of music that is good music, that is conducive of the ends that we seek, which are edification and spiritual growth and the rigors of Christian discipleship requiring self-control and discipline. That's the kind of music that we're going to need to find. So again, this author that I have been reading, Calvin Seipert, summarizes the whole period saying whether, that is of the church fathers, whether they were Greek-speaking or Latin-speaking, pre or post-Constantine, conciliatory or antagonistic toward pagan learning, lifelong Christians or converts, whatever their background or personality, they agreed that Christians should distance themselves from most of the music of the surrounding culture. In other words, there's just uniform, vehement denunciation of pagan music and its destructive impact upon Christian discipleship. Now, if you fast forward from the philosophers of antiquity to the church fathers to the reformers, you'll find that Calvin particularly will connect the dots for you. He will cite the fathers. He will say, for example, Calvin cites the precedent of the ancient doctors of the church. That's his way of referring to the church fathers, who he says denounce the dishonest and shameless songs to which their contemporaries were addicted as mortal and satanic poison for corrupting the world. That's Calvin. Mortal and satanic poison for the corrupting of the world. Oh, you say, well, that's just a tune. That's just music. That's no big deal. It's just a song. That's not his view. That's not his view. That's not the Father's view. That's not the ancient philosopher's view. Don't just say it's just music. It's not just music. That trivializes music. That undermines the true importance of music. Often I find that people who are addicted to music, one at the same time, who allow music to have this central, virtually central place in their lives. And you understand that's really the way the culture is today. The amount of time being spent listening to recorded music is phenomenal. So they give it this central place in their lives, this place of prominence and this allotment of time that is paralleled virtually in no other part of their lives. At the same time, want to say that music's not important. Isn't there some irony in that? That a culture that is addicted to music, enslaved to it virtually, wants to say at the same time, but it's not important. There's some schizophrenia, I think, about that perspective. Let me continue with Calvin. Building upon the thought of Augustine, Calvin recognizes music as a gift of God, whose aim is recreating man and giving him pleasure. However, Calvin urges its moderate use lest it become what he says is the occasion for our giving free rein to dissolution, moral breakdown, or making ourselves effeminate in disordered heights. Much of the music, he's saying, was destructive of masculinity, true masculinity. Or becoming the instrument of lasciviousness and shamelessness. Then Calvin goes on, taking a cue from Plato, whom he names, he observes, there is scarcely in the world anything which is more able to turn or bend this way or that the morals of men, as Plato prudently considered it. And in fact, we find by experience that it has a sacred and almost incredible power to move hearts in one way or another. What does? Music does. Don't trivialize music. Don't underestimate the power of music. In our civilization today, with this tendency that we have, we are completely at odds with the universal opinion, virtually, of humanity going back as far as recorded records are kept, of the power of music either to corrupt the soul or to discipline and edify the soul. Continuing, Calvin distinguishes words from tunes, arguing that when bad words are joined to appealing melodies, the song, he says, pierces the heart much more strongly and enters into it in a like manner as through a funnel the wine is poured into the vessel. You got the picture there? Like having a funnel directly into your heart. When you take bad words and bad music and it's just pouring directly into your soul with all of its destructive power. So also the venom and corruption is distilled to the depths of the heart by the melody. In like manner, he says, as through a funnel, the wine is poured into the vessel, so also the venom and the corruption is distilled to the depths of the heart by the melody. In modern times, the philosophers right up into the 20th century would have agreed. Right up into the middle of the 20th century, the theologians would have agreed, including those most respected by the world, like Bonhoeffer and Karl Barth, both of whom have said similar things. There is, in other words, a great cloud of witnesses that we should be very, very slow to ignore as they counsel us with regards to our musical environment. Next, I want to say something about the nature of music. First, music has a subjective element, very subjective element. We're fond of saying in our house, there's no accounting for taste, right? We all have our opinions. We all have our preferences. We all have our styles. This is what I like. That's what you like. There's a very, very strong subjective element when it comes to music. However, music is also objective in that it partakes of the natural created order. Music is rooted in the physical material environment. So that tonality, harmony, what it means to be on key, those are rooted in the fabric of creation. Those are not just subjective opinions. You're either on key or you're off key. You're either in harmony or you're out of harmony. Music is made up of the movement of air on vocal cords. That's physical. Ears that hear, horns, drums. To be on key and in harmony and in tune is a way of describing sound as it relates to the physical world. Of bows on strings as heard by ears. There are musical rules that are rooted in the created order, in the natural order, in the physical world. There are laws of gravity and laws of physics. Well, there are sonic rules as well that either are obeyed or one ends up with a cacophony of awful sounds. Furthermore, music evokes certain universal responses. There is music that makes us weep, music that excites us, music that gladdens us, music that soothes us. David played music for Saul that soothed his tortured soul. There is music that evokes the martial spirit, marching music. There's music that prepares for romance. Perhaps all music has some proper function, perhaps. I'm not going to say that absolutely, but perhaps it all has some function, somewhere, sometime, someplace. The third, and I want to talk about wisdom regarding our musical environment. I want to say, number one, be discerning. I'm very reluctant to get into the musical realm, but here it is. Most people are very defensive about their music, and that's just what they say about it. This is my music. The Apostle Paul here is saying that if we're walking as wise people, we're going to be speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in our hearts to the Lord. When we sing to the Lord. The Lord's words, the Lord's music. So, if you're to be discerning, here's the kind of questions that I think that you and I are going to need to ask. Number one, what is the impact of this music? What do the words say? You see, I don't listen to the words. That's not legitimate. Not according to the great cloud of witnesses we've just cited. You can't say you don't listen to the words. The words have a way of insinuating themselves, of infiltrating and penetrating our souls. Ask yourself, are the words consistent with Christian discipleship? Are the words immoral or vulgar or violent? Then they're absolutely prohibited to us. We ought to burn those records. We ought to destroy those CDs. We ought to make sure that they're erased from every recorded medium that we have. We cannot listen to music accompanied by words that are immoral or vulgar or violent or crude or sensuous. That is completely contrary to the teaching of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. And just because I like that music, that's no excuse for listening to it. Then, beyond that, are the words consistent with Christian courtship ideals? Most pop music has to do with the relationships between unmarried people. All right, so is the music that I'm listening to, is it consistent with the ideals of Christian courtship? For example, is the person about whom one is singing, is that person being viewed as an object for one's own pleasure, either overtly or by suggestion? Does the song speak of an irrational attachment? Now, a lot of these are trivial, and a lot of my examples are just the classics of rock, because I've not bothered to keep up with it. Little Surfer, Little One, Let My Heart Come All Undone, Makes My Heart Come All Undone. I mean, is that really a Christian view of courtship? Makes my heart come all undone? Like, that's what I'm supposed to do, just irrationally let my heart unravel before this beauty that I've met on the beach, who also surfs. It's in one sense a harmless song, but is it really consistent with the way that you want to treat your sons to look at the young women, and young women to look at young men, and the way that you want to approach them and think of them, and when the time comes to consider them for marriage, to approach them and think of them and sing about them? Are the words consistent with the nature of the relationship, in that does it express an unjustified ownership of the member of the opposite sex? Like, she's mine. That sort of language is so common in popular music. She's mine. He's mine. Is she yours? How is she yours? By what right do you claim ownership of her? By what right do you restrict her choices? By what right do you claim exclusive attention from her? Are you engaged to her? Are you married to her? Then I reckon she's not yours, is she? If you're not married to her and you're not engaged to her, do you have any legal claim upon her? Do you have any moral claim upon her? What is the nature of this claim, this restriction, this ownership that you're claiming on this other person? And is that consistent with the ideals of Christian courtship? How about our crass descriptions of members of the opposite sex, of their appeal or of their sensuality? I think it's helpful to think in terms of sisters and daughters. This song that you love, do you want your sister being sung about in the way that artist is singing of his beloved? Is that the way you would want your daughter? Is that the language you want a male suitor using as he approaches your daughter? How many of the songs, they're top 40 popular songs today. How many of those songs do you think that they are expressing their attachment to the member of the opposite sex is being done so in a way that you would like for that suitor to speak of your daughter, your sister, your son, your brother? I reckon about 90% of it just falls by that criteria all by itself. So much of it is sensual, so much of it is possessive, so much of it is self-centered and egotistical. So much of it is expressing ideals that are contrary to Christian discipleship. In other words, so much of pop music just needs to be thrown onto the trash heap and burned. Why? Because it is so inconsistent with Christian discipleship, either overtly or in a more subtle way. It is not healthy for us. It is not good for us. And to think of it as harmless is a unique perspective, put it that way, in the history of the world and in the history of the Christian church. Another question, what response does the tune evoke? And is that response appropriate? Does the music encourage a casting off of restraint and abandonment to one's passions? Now, that kind of music may be okay for the marital bedroom, but it wouldn't be appropriate anywhere else, would it? Wouldn't be appropriate on the dance floor. Wouldn't be appropriate at the party. Wouldn't be appropriate at the ball game. In fact, I think a interesting insight into the response evoked by any given genre of music would be to observe how do people dance to that music. All right, you take, look, we just got our little 3 and 4 year olds out here and popped a certain kind of rock and roll on. You know what they would start doing? They would abandon themselves to their passions. They'd start jumping around, leaping around, spinning around. They would just go crazy. They'd do it right here. I've seen it happen. I've seen it at weddings. The band strikes up and they just go wild. Why? Because the music is of the nature that it evokes that kind of response. That's why people dance as they do to that kind of music. So that gives you an insight into the nature of the music. The dancing is expressive of the kind of responses that that genre evokes. And so you then need to ask, you know, if that is a valid kind of response for a Christian. The dancing that accompanies the tango or rock and roll or soft pop or disco or rap, most of it is offensive. Most of it is absolutely off limits for Christian people. That bump and grind style that today is beyond off limits. It's animalistic. And yet the Christian young people are just distressingly undiscerning in their bodily movements and so forth that are merely the expression of the natural response to the music being worked out in public on the dance floor. So number one, I would say be discerning. Ask yourself those kinds of questions. What's the impact of this music? What are the words saying? Are the words in conflict with Christian discipleship? What kind of response does the tune evoke? Say, secondly, limit pop music. I'd address myself to the parents. I'd say, parents, you do realize that often you're the problem, that you are so addicted to music that is incompatible with Christian discipleship that you can't let it go, and so you've indoctrinated your children with it. Probably 90% of the music, and these are rough numbers, 90% of the music, pop music that we all listen to, has got to go. It may be as high as 99%. I would encourage you not to play the radio indiscriminately, where just one song after another comes on. I would encourage you not to play most pop music aloud in the house. Don't let it be a part of the musical environment of the house. I would keep it away, almost in an absolute sense, from all preteens. Why? Because it's bad music. It's bad artistically. It's bad aesthetically. It's bad morally. It encourages the immediate expression of impulses. It is consistent with a philosophy of immediate self-gratification. Third, do encourage listening to great music, the classics, such as the great composers, Bach, Handel, Mozart, Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Mendelssohn, Strauss. The folk tradition, also, Old Home on the Range. When your children are growing up, I'd encourage you to expose them to the American folk tradition, as well as the English and Irish and Welsh and so forth. The English-speaking folk tradition, the Bonnie Blue Flag, and there's a whole host of music. I just read an article on this the other day. There is a whole genre of the American folk tradition that has absolutely vanished. That was a part of everybody's upbringing a generation or two ago. It's just gone. It has disappeared from our cultural experience today. What our grandparents and great-grandparents all grew up singing out of the American folk tradition is virtually unknown. In fact, that article listed, I guess, a dozen different songs. I knew one. I knew one. And that was it. There's also the sacred tradition of hymns. I'd encourage listening to good music. Good music drives out bad music. And so from infancy, you were beginning to shape their tastes musically so that they're aware of fine craftsmanship, so that they're aware of the sound of great music. Take them to concerts of classical music so that they're able, concerts can be life-changing when they're able to hear firsthand, in person, not just recorded. And then thirdly, provide a musical education so that every child plays an instrument. So again, they grow up to recognize craftsmanship and excellence. Why all this? Because the Apostle Paul, indicating by his placement of this exhortation to speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, he's indicating by that this is a necessary ingredient in our sanctification. We have to pay attention to our musical environment. Why? Because bad music corrupts. Bad lyrics corrupt. Bad tunes corrupt. And because they do, you need to put off the old and the corruptible and put on the new, and that which will edify and that which will strengthen and discipline the soul. Ear takes my children to no end. But when I hear them humming a tune, I'll say, what psalm is that? Is that the 23rd psalm I'm hearing? Oh, Dad. Well, the Apostle Paul says, when you sing, sing what? This is not a passage about worship. This is about life. This is about not being unwise, but being wise. This is about being an imitator of God as your beloved children. When you sing, what should you sing? Sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Why? So that's what you're filling your heart with rather than with the rubbish that's coming out of popular culture today. As we pray together.